Last time we began a look at the second paragraph in Romans chapter 6, and we were looking at, it's a very short paragraph, just three verses basically. But it's a kind of conclusion to the first paragraph, verses 1 through 11. And it's, in a sense, an introduction into the next paragraph, which runs from verse 15 all the way to the end of the chapter. Because the issues are, according to verse 14, compared to chapter 6, verse 1, the issue of grace. Verse 14, you're under grace. Verse 15, what shall we say then? Shall we sin because we're not under law but under grace? So this whole chapter presupposes and is rooted in the reality that God has moved us away from a realm of judgment and law into a realm of family and grace and extensive mercy. And in our study last time, particularly, we were looking at verses 12 and 14 as beginning and ending of a loop in which the command is made in verse 12 that we stop letting the sin have its dominion like a king in our mortal bodies. And then in verse 14, because we are under grace and not under law, sin will not be able to play the master or lord role over us. So there was a difference between the king as a ruler and the lord as a judgment or judge. And so that's kind of the loop. We're not supposed to let sin, we're supposed to stop letting sin be the king, and then we're supposed to count on the fact that sin will not be our lord. So basically, we're looking at a succession of ideas from chapter 6, verses 1 through 11, where he wound that up by saying that we are to consider or recognize or reason our way through, the word consider being the word for those three elements that are involved in faith, where we look at issues, we see the difference between the options, we draw a conclusion about which of those is the truth, and then we submit ourselves to that so that action takes place out of that submission. We're supposed to do that in relation to the idea that we're dead to sin but alive to God. Now, most of us have equal amount of trouble with both those concepts. Most of us don't feel like we're dead to the sin, and most of us don't really feel like we're alive to the God. But that's what he says we're supposed to be focused on in terms of our believing, and that's really reinforced in verse 13. In verse 12, stop letting the sin rule as a king in your mortal body so that you end up doing the lust that the sin is involved with, and do not go on presenting the members of your body to the sin as instruments of unrighteousness, but present yourself to God as those who are alive from the dead, and your members then as instruments of righteousness to God. So that's where we're going this evening. We're going to look at this issue of where the hupakuo concept that is introduced particularly in verse 12 under the translation obey. The sin only has its ability to dominate our mortal bodies and the members of them when we buy into the lies and believe them, and then our behavior is determined by the faith that's there in those lies. So hupakuo means to listen and then submit to. Well, that's the whole idea of listening to the options, making a decision about which one of them is true, and then deciding on the basis of that, that we will operate by faith in that, and the operation automatically flows. And as I said last time, this is Genesis 3 all over and over and over and over. Options, clear as day. God says you'll die. Satan says you won't. You've got to decide who you're going to believe. And then as soon as you submit yourself to whichever one you've chosen, your behavior follows just like night follows day or day follows night. That's the way it was in Genesis 3. It's still the way it is in 2016. So I want us to look at verse 13 as an exhortation under the exhortation. In other words, the exhortation is in verse 12. Stop letting the sin be the king in your mortal body. Verse 13 is, and do not go on presenting the members of your body to the sin. So he's talking about some things that go hand in glove together. So I call this the exhortation's exhortation. Stop and then don't keep on. So in order for those of us who believe to stop permitting the sin to act as a king in our mortal bodies, we have to come to grips with all four of the aspects of biblical faith. There has to be, in the idea of biblical faith, at some point, an exposure to the actual content that is to be believed. In other words, there has to be a listening to actual words. That's the akouo element, where you hear. And hearing is a metaphor for however it comes into your brain. Whether it's hearing or reading or however it comes into your brain, you get the content, the declaration, however it comes. When God says, you shall surely die, it comes into Adam and Eve's brains as a statement that this will happen. And when Satan says, you will not surely die, it comes into their brains as a declaration that's completely opposed to this one. And there is the setup. So the beginning of biblical faith is listening to the actual words. And it just naturally fits in my temperament and personality to use that as a justification for focusing on the details of the words. Because you really do have to think your way through all this stuff if you're going to have a sure foundation in what you believe to be the truth. So that's where it starts. That's the fundamental basic issue in starting out with biblical faith, listening to the actual words that God has declared. And then I think just as clearly as that is the first thing, it is also clear that there are few situations where words are used that don't contain contradictory words in the same situation. In other words, options. Somebody says this, and somebody says, but you forgot about this. And so that changes the whole thing around. Well, as soon as you have the declaration here and the contradiction there, you're set up with this issue of the basic reality of most of our lives. There are very few situations in life that we face that don't have this is true, or no, but this is true kind of set up. And so not only do we have to listen to the actual words, the words have to begun to be thought about. We have to reason our way through what the claims of the words are. Because this declaration and that declaration, something has to give. Somebody's got to decide which one of these is true. So that's the second part. The situations in life are situations where we run into confusion because we have a feeling that the words, we've understood them this way, but this circumstance seems to be arguing that we ought to understand them that way. So we have to think about it. And then thirdly, there is the fact that simply drawing academic conclusions about which one's true will not carry the day. It doesn't do any good at all to decide, okay, I'm going to go with this one rather than that one. If, in fact, the going doesn't mean anything. If it's just an academic, this is the truth. That's not the truth. And that's the end of it. There will not be any fruitfulness from that because biblical faith says you hear and submit. You hear and yield. And that's, I think the whole idea of yielding under huppah, put yourself under it, that's the whole idea I've argued many, many times, that faith is not something you proactively generate. It's something you yield to when it's made obvious that it's true. And it's the Spirit of God's job to make things obvious. If He doesn't, we have no hope. The whole world is complicated enough. We don't even have a real good idea about how complex God's creation is. It's immense and enormously complex, and we've just barely scratched the surface of that complexity. But the scratch that we've made leaves us bum-puzzled because it's so complex, and that's just this. So in the reality of having to deal with this, listening and then submitting to has the concept of actually yielding to it. Okay, I'm convinced. This is the way it is. And then, out of that conviction that this is true, there will be, biblically, a commensurate response that's in harmony with it. If there is not a commensurate response, then all the claim to believing it is just talk. You cannot honestly claim to have submitted yourself to a thing that's true if, when that thing that's true applies to this situation and you don't do what the biblical thing calls for. You can't say you believe it. You can say, I agree with it, I don't have any argument with it, but I'm not going there. That's just hearing. That's not hearing with submission. An enormous amount of Christianity is right there, at least in our cultural setting in 21st century American Christianity. It's just hear and no decisions, no commitments, no follow through. And I think part of the reason is because of the issue of commensurate response. And we're going to talk about that. The issue of the actual nature of the commensurate response has always been hotly contested. Almost to a man, the human race runs from concept to response way too quickly. We find it in the Christian community stated like this: a true believer will never, and you just fill in the blank. Can a person be a real believer and just fill in the blank? I had numerous people over my ministry lifetime ask me those kind of questions, and it just depends on their particular issue that they're wrapped up in as to what they're going to do with the blank. Can a true believer abort their baby? Well, for a person who's really wrapped up in the abortion debate, no. But that's not reality. That's like, can a true believer smoke a cigarette? Well, that just depends on how opposed to smoking you are. How are you going to answer that? Well, the fact is, those kind of statements, true believers would never, or true believers won't, or true believers will, and then they stack on whatever positive thing, that is almost invariably an expression of the fact that you believe that a person who's believed in Jesus will automatically do these kind of things and not do those kind of things just because they believed in Jesus. And how do you read the New Testament and come up with that? The whole New Testament is full of the fact that true believers have pulled almost every kind of stunt there is. I pulled out the one last time that is just so remarkable in 1 Corinthians 15. True believers saying, there's no such thing as resurrection from the dead. Well, that is so irrational compared to the thing that they believed, that Jesus rose on the third day according to the scriptures. How did they get from believing that to this kind of irrationality? Well, irrationality is part of the human condition. That's how they got there. It's just built in. And this is the root, I think, of a lot of flawed theology and a great deal of self-righteous condemnation of those who actually do the action involved in the declaration. When a person says a true believer would never, they're assuming and declaring to everybody that hears them that they would never do that or never have as a believer. And the truth of that matter is, you don't know what you'll do until you're in the situation. And it's particularly true that you don't know what you're going to do 10 years from now. So there's a lot of, well, I would never do that. Well, pardon me, but given the right kind of pressures and the right kind of setting, you sure might. And there is no guarantee that you won't. We would like to be confident that we wouldn't, but there are just too many examples in the Bible of really relatively mature believers pulling some really dumb stunts by the things they chose to do under the pressure of a given moment. So, I'm going to make this claim. The scriptures do not support an extensive link between faith and behaviors, as though a person can believe a singular aspect of truth and then act across the board of life, as if that singular truth automatically governs all of the multitude of behaviors that surface in the person's life every day. What I mean is, I can genuinely believe that Jesus is my Savior, and in the conflict of thought and my immaturity, actually deny that the Bible is the Word of God. Because I did it. I can do that. When I came to know Christ as my Savior, the Spirit of God took up residence in me. I became very conscience aware and very sensitive to things that I knew were sinful. So when I would be engaged in them, I would be smitten in my conscience and I would respond to them by confessing the sin and so on. But one day, Charlie Crusoe and Jerry were debating at the table in our house over whether something in Genesis was which way, you know, because Charlie was Church of Christ and Jerry wasn't. And I just said, well, what difference does it make? It's just written by a man. In effect, I was denying the Bible as the Word of God. It was just the Word of a man. Well, where did that come from? It came from ignorance. And the fact that faith in this truth does not guarantee corresponding behavior across the board of life. It just doesn't. Faith in a single fact is never comprehensive in terms of the believer's ability to see how that fact addresses all the rest of the details of life. I didn't see, as a new believer, the connection between believing what the Bible said and then turning around and saying, it's just the word of a man. I didn't see the contradiction there. Nobody had ever pointed it out to me until that event. So that's how it works. Immaturity and not understanding and the fact that you can actually honestly believe something, but out of ignorance and lack of understanding, turn around and directly contradict something that's strongly implied in the thing you do believe by your behavior and statements. The scriptures don't teach that believing a single fact will be comprehensive in our ability to act right in all of the details of life. Secondly, the details of living are innumerable in their variety. And no one can understand all of them as it relates to which fact to believe in this particular setting and time. Of all of the facts that I've been exposed to and submitted to as truth, which of them applies in this setting, at this time, in this debate? Which one am I supposed to trust, depend on in that thing? And you see that in Abraham with going down to Egypt and telling Sarah to say, well, just tell the king you're my sister, and that way he won't kill me. He's going to take you into his harem, but he won't kill me. Well, rationally, there was no way he could be dead. As long as Sarah wasn't pregnant, there was no way Abraham could die, because God had promised him a son. As long as she wasn't carrying a baby, he was safe as he could be. But he didn't reach that rational conclusion because there were too many complications and his understanding was too small. So with the innumerable hosts of details that come with everyday living, we many times stumble over, what am I supposed to believe here? And then thirdly, the entire issue of faith as a behavior controlling thing is really beyond human capacity. You can't make yourself believe something just so that it'll produce the kind of behavior that you think you ought to produce. If it's really true that faith is a result of the grace of God in operation where He convinces you of something that's true, if He convinces you that it's true and you yield to it, then your behavior will be affected by it, but not otherwise. If you find a verse in the Bible and it says something and you think it means a given thing, if God hasn't convinced you that that's true, your thinking will not carry you through the day. And when push comes to shove, you'll find yourself waffling because you'll know that you just drew this conclusion. You weren't really convicted by the Spirit that it was true. That's what it seems to mean. And when push comes to shove, seems to mean just doesn't hack it. So, the whole point here is that the scriptures themselves do not support an extensive link between believing a particular and then governing your behavior across the wide scope of life. Therefore, we come to Paul's second exhortation here. He says, stop letting sin be the king in your mortal body so that you obey its lusts. And do not go on presenting the members of your body to sin, to the sin, as instruments of unrighteousness. The issue to stop sin from exercising the dominion of a king means that you have to come to grips with just how do you do that? How do you keep the sin from being the king in your mortal body? Well, we've already hinted at it in the word obey in verse 12. You have to know what the sin's lies are, because the sin is ruling its kingdom on the basis of lies that are presented as truth, and the people of the kingdom are buying the lies as truth, and as a result, their submission to the rules follow. So that's part of it. But Paul's assumption in verse 13 is that there's actually something a little bit more particular that you have to do. You have to take the issue of what he is translated here, presenting. Presenting. That word presenting is a word that means to stand something beside something else. And in most of the contexts where it's used, the thing that stood beside the other thing is stood there in order that the thing that it's standing beside might receive some benefit from it. In other words, it's kind of like the psalmist says, the Lord is at my right hand, I shall not be moved. That means that the Lord has presented himself beside this individual with the result that he strengthens him so that he won't be moved. And that's the way you find it in the scriptures used. You present yourself to a widow, for example, and that means you stand beside her to help with the need that she has. That's the way the word is used through the New Testament. So that's the idea of presentation, and it's clear that Paul believed that the sin is set up for defeat by one thing, and that is the believer really does have a say-so over what his or her body members will do. I really do have some sort of a say-so over what my feet do, my hands do, my tongue does, my eyes do, and so on. I have something in there, because he wouldn't tell me to do this thing called presenting the members of your body. He wouldn't say that if I couldn't do it, if there's nothing there to be actually done. And in verse 13, the presenting of the members to your body to the sin as instruments of unrighteousness opens the door for the sin to produce the fulfillment of its lusts through the mortal body. So you present your members to the sin, and then the sin just runs crazy with the permission that you've given, because that's what presentation is. It's a permission. So, no one, apparently, does anything without a presentation of the members of the body to the controlling spirit that's involved. However, the primary issue in the first part of verse 13 is the presentation to the sin, as opposed to, in verse the middle of the verse, presenting yourselves to God, to the God, literally. So here you have alternatives. You have a presentation to the sin or a presentation to the God. If you do your presentation to the sin, then the sin will just run amok. Well, what happens if you do your presentation to the God? Does he just then take over and run amok? Well, there's a difference, and we'll address that difference in just a minute. But the fact is that the sin demands the right of the king in this issue. And so to present my members to the sin means that I'm going to agree that the sin is the king. He has the right to make the rules, and I'm just going to be run over by the rules, and he'll just run amok through my body with its lusts and so on. Unfortunately for us, the God doesn't operate the same way, because the God, in the middle of the verse, where you present yourselves to the God is not looking for a body to run amok in. He is summoning us to the rationality of this demand that the sin is making. Is it rational to give the sin the position of king over your mortal body. Is that rational? And obviously it's not. So that's the first thing he's challenging us with. And then secondly, neither the sin nor the God has the prerogative of dominating the members of the body without the permission that's involved in the presentation. Sin, the sin, cannot use your mortal body instruments or your mortal body members as instruments until you give it permission to do so. By the same token, because God's objective is to produce behavior that's genuinely love-driven, because he's not going to reward anything that's not love-driven in the kingdom, and he's going to start us off in the kingdom after he's evaluated all of the behavior of our lifetime and seen how much of it is driven by the love of God, and therefore we're going to start off with this, whatever is the result of the evaluation, being motivated by true love. That will profit us. And because God is after love-motivated behavior, he's not looking for just behavior. Sin doesn't care whether you love it or not, whether you really want to be submissive to it or not. All it cares for is for you to give it permission. And then it uses your body however it wants to and laughs at you in all of the mess that you create and all the pain you are indulged in because of your choices. He just laughs at you because you were foolish enough to give him permission. Well, part of the reason why it's like this is because Paul clearly believed, according to verse 13, that there is this ongoing issue of presenting. Do not go on presenting, but instead present yourself. The idea here is that you really do have to give permission. Anybody who's ever been overwhelmed by some, well, we'll just call it some habit or some bondage, somebody who's been engaged in a certain kind of behavior long enough to really get in bondage to that behavior, even when the person is clearly in bondage, there is still a demand made by the sin that you present this member of your body to me to do what I want it to. And the raging conflict goes, and the whole intention of the sin is, there is no point in resisting me. And finally the person throws up his hands in despair and submits. But the fact is, he submits, gives permission. And once permission is granted, a whole lot of things do flow. Jesus said, if you commit sin, you become the servant of it. So, you have to be very careful where you give your permissions, because once a permission is granted, it's very difficult to rescind it later. It's not impossible, but it's difficult. Permissions tend to follow prior permissions. So these presentations are an ongoing reality. You have to stop presenting your members to the sin. You have to stop giving it permission. But how do you go about doing that? Well, I think that's what the last half of the verse is all about. But let me just say this about the sin. I think Paul realizes and makes the assumption that the sin has an edge simply because the sin is rooted in the Adamic presentation. Adam presented the members of his body to Satan in his yielding to the arguments that Satan made and disobeying God's instruction. He presented his members to Satan. Well, that presentation as the federal head of the human race has a lot of implications for everybody that comes after him. In fact, Romans 5 says everybody that comes after him just pretty much automatically presents, because he did. Permissions follow permissions. And there is this edge that is rooted in the fact that we're born into this world as the children of Adam. But it's only an edge rooted in the fact that permissions lead to permissions. It's not a suspension of the basic reality that there is a necessity for the presentation. If there wasn't a necessity for it, you would never argue with yourself about whether you ought to resist this or not. There would be no conflict in your thinking. But there's also an assumption that the contradiction of the earlier presentation has to be countered by deliberate presentation. And I want you to notice how he argues it in the middle of the verse. He does not say, do not go on presenting the members of your body to sin as instruments of unrighteousness, but go on presenting your members as of your bodies as instruments of righteousness. He doesn't say it that way. He says, you stop and you present yourself to God. This word present is exactly the same word that's used in Romans 12:1, where you present your body as a living sacrifice to God. You present your body. And then, according to verse 2, you do not let yourself be poured in the world's mold so that you're conformed to it by the renewing of your mind. So that you stop the presenting to the sin by stopping and saying, whoa, I am going to present myself to the God. And once that happens, a lot of those other presentations that were going to follow on the original presentation, that just cuts that whole process off. Because all of a sudden, the sin no longer is the king in your body. You have presented yourself to the God. Now he's the king. Well, this whole foundation, the assumption that you can stop the process by presenting yourself to God, and then you can present your members as instruments of righteousness to the God, that whole idea is that there is a possibility of victory in this whole issue of life and overcoming ongoing failures. But notice how you're to do that. You present yourselves to God as those alive from the dead. I don't believe, on the one hand, that... I don't believe, on the one hand, that presenting yourself to God without a clear understanding that you are now alive will do you any good at all. I think the real issue with most believers is there is this overwhelming sense of there is no point. I can't win here. There is no way. Well, what you're saying when you say that is, I'm still dead. But we're to present ourselves to God as those alive from the dead. Well, what does that mean? It means you got to believe the first 11 verses and you got to reckon on it. Verse 11 says, consider yourself to be alive. Well, if I'm really alive, I can really present my body, I can really present myself to God. I can really do that. It's a thing I can actually achieve. That's the first thing I think is crucial. We have to understand that we're alive and we can take this action. But then, I really do believe that the presentation is the commensurate response to the faith. I do not believe that the outcome of the presentation is the commensurate response. What I mean by that is this. I think at the very root of human reality is the knee-jerk legalism that is built into us. That's why we're scared to present ourselves to God. Because we think, my thought was this, if I present myself to God, he'll make me to be a preacher. Well, fortunately, God just kind of overruled that, because the day I was presented with the reality that I was supposed to present myself to God, I went home that night and did it. And when I was doing it, I wasn't thinking, oh, I hate the thought that God's going to make me a preacher. I hate the thought. I didn't. That thought was just erased from my brain. It wasn't an objection. And the fact is, God did what I expected in my initial thing. But my point is, God did it. I didn't go from presenting myself to God to automatically then saying, okay, now I got to be a preacher. I got to do this. I got to do that. I got to do that. I didn't. I went from presenting myself to God to a gradual shift in thinking that I believe was of the Spirit of God. Over a little period of time, I discovered that I really, really, really wanted to be able to explain the Scriptures to other people. And then out of that came this conviction that I really needed to go to Bible college and get the instruction that I needed about the Scriptures. And I'd already been accepted by General Motors Institute to go to their school to become an engineer for General Motors. But I decided that that's past, this is now the course I need to take. And when I got to college, in Bible college, I didn't feel like I just have to do this work, and I have to do this work, and I have to do this work, and I have to do this work. It wasn't about having to. It was the natural flow of desire. And I really believe that's why Paul says in verse 13, in the middle of the verse, you present yourself to God, and He accepts the presentation. And then, if you believe the Scriptures, Philippians is very clear, makes this very clear statement. It is God who works in you, both the willing and the doing of His good pleasure. Well, now, if it's God who produces in us the willing and the doing, then it is no longer us that must come up with the willingness and the doingness. We do have to make the presentation because God's not just going to run roughshod over us. His objective is to develop a life that's driven by love, first for Him and then for others. And if I respond to His love with love and present myself to Him, it's up to Him to do whatever He wants with it after the fact. And that's the commitment that He has made. He works in us, the willing and the doing. Now, it doesn't mean that life's just easy from then on, because there's a huge hindrance in this ongoing process. The reason why we present ourselves to God and then we present our members as instruments of righteousness to the God is because there is this huge hindrance that Satan continues to hammer on, and I call it scenario building. Scenario building is the idea that if I decide this, then this will result. Well, who's to say that? I have never seen the Scriptures say that if I decide this, this will automatically happen, because I don't have any control about the future. I can make my decision, but there is no... I mean, even the proverb says, man makes a decision, God disposes. He's the, you know, man proposes and God disposes. That's a biblical reality. Well, the whole point there is, I can be dissuaded from presenting myself to God simply out of fear of what that might mean. And that's a scenario building thing that Satan delights in generating. So, if we're going to be successful in walking with God by presenting ourselves to Him and then our members as instruments of righteousness to Him, if we're going to be successful in that, we cannot undercut the process by saying, if I present myself to God, if I present my member to God, then this is going to be the result, and I don't want that to be the result, so I'm not going to do it. We can't do that. God isn't as dumb as we think He is. He knows that we're not going to do what we're not motivated to do. So, if He wants us to do something, what's He got to do? Give us the motivation to do it. Now, that doesn't mean that Satan won't oppose. That's why verse 13 is there. Don't present yourself to the sin. Stop that process. But on the other hand, Satan in a very real sense presented you to Satan as one of his offspring. And we have to take that presentation back by presenting ourselves to God and then letting Him set up the scenario of how we work from there. And then we present our members to Him day by day by day, to do whatever it is He sets up for us to do. And He sets up the willing and the doing, and it works by the Spirit. So I really believe that verse 13 is key to what Paul was trying to say in the first 11 verses, where we're united together with Christ in His life post-death, and therefore we have the capacity to actively present ourselves to God. That's the commensurate response to the truth here. So it's not I present myself to God and then I present myself to do all of this other stuff. I present myself to God and then He sets up the stuff that's to follow. And in the stuff that's to follow, I keep presenting the members of my body to Him to accomplish these things. So I think that's what's going on in verse 13.